Hello and welcome to the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. I am your host, Gary Gramling. I'll be joined by a special guest in just a moment. This is part two of the series we're doing on the players who had their fifth-year options decline. And I know that's not like a terribly sexy title, but these are basically the first-round picks in 2017 who their teams, or in some cases, a team that acquired them since then, just kind of said, we're probably not committing to these guys. Maybe we will. Maybe we'll change our mind after the 2020 season, but probably not. We got NFC last week. That included Mitchell Trubisky, some other guys there. This week, AFC, no quarterbacks, but a couple of really fascinating cases coming out of the AFC South here. But we'll get to it right now as I introduce our very special guest. You'll never believe who it is. It's Andy Benoit is back.
Hey, Gary. How are you?
I'm good. Andy, your quarantine beard is
it's going everywhere, isn't it? It was getting rave reviews, and then somebody close to me said, "Remember what Dwight Schrute's cousin looked like on The Office?
Yeah.
Kind of the quasi Amish guy, whatever he was, but very round beard, kind of multi-directional in terms of where the hairs were pointing." So I need to get it. Adjust. I need to trim it down.
No, I mean, look, you're not in full HD as I look upon you here, but I think it's pretty legit. Maybe the lighting's doing you a favor too. You're kind of backlit.
I am. Yeah, I got a big window behind me.
Yeah. Well, with that said, let's get to it. We are starting with the number four pick of the 2017 draft, Leonard Fournette. Look, controversial pick when it was made because he is a power running back. He is not completely worthless in the passing game, but it's certainly not a strength of his. They did use him more last year, but it's just not. No one's going to mistake this guy for a Christian McCaffrey or anything. But Fournette, they are to the point where they're trying to shop him, and there are just no takers. And it just sort of raises the question. I mean, we saw what Derrick Henry did, and not that Fournette is exactly that kind of back, but Derrick Henry is. You know, the Cliff Notes version is he is a big power back with not a lot of value in the passing game. Leonard Fournette is kind of along those same lines. Is there a place in the league for a guy like this as a feature back?
Well, the difference between, and I know we're not, I know you're not suggesting Leonard Fournette is Derrick Henry, but it's a great place to start the conversation. And I think then we have to understand what the difference between those guys would be. And Henry is a much more powerful runner than Fournette, and he has a build-up speed and momentum and an acceleration about three or four steps into his run, a second gear, in other words. It's not really a second gear, though. He doesn't shift into it. He's a build-up speed guy. Fournette does not have that kind of gear. Fournette is a lot more one-dimensional in terms of being a power runner, and there have been a lot of times, quite frankly, Gary, and injuries have factored into this, and maybe we don't know how much. So you want to be fair when you say something like this. But there have been a lot of times, frankly, where Fournette has not even been a power runner, where he's been soft at the point of contact. I know the coaching staff in Jacksonville felt that was an issue a few years ago. And so he has not been able to run effectively when he's less than 100% healthy. Let's put it that way. And every once in a while, you do see big flashes of Fournette, the power back and the subtle wiggle, but it's not there nearly consistently enough. And when it is there, it's not nearly as dynamic as a Derrick Henry would be in that sense.
He had 76 catches last year. Which,
did he,
I mean,
really?
Look,
that surprises me.
If you're a fantasy football player, that pleases you. 76 catches, only 522 yards off of those 76 catches, which also tells something of a story. But I mean, like I said, no one's going to mistake the guy for a true third down passing skills back here. But could his career be sort of carved out by an ability to become, like, you know, decent in the passing game? And then you have a guy who's sort of a decent runner and is decent in the passing game and is a little bit injury prone.
Well, yeah, I mean, sure, but now you're just describing any running back that gets into the NFL. I mean, that's where the conversation gets really hard, is what is something Leonard Fournette does that a typical fifth-round running back would not do? Something where he's drastically better than the typical fifth-round back.
Yep. No, I agree with you. Look, the Jaguars shopped him. There were no takers. I mean, were you surprised at all that there were no takers for him?
No, because of what we just said. A team can, and those fifth round backs, and even if you want to go third round, I mean, whatever, you can get a younger back who's healthier than Fournette, who's going to be cheaper, and maybe he's not quite as good, maybe. But the bottom line is, this style of runner, we're still talking about a runner who is dependent on his blocking and whose pass receiving numbers are going to be a function of the offense and the way the action plays out. So I'm surprised Fournette had as many catches as he did. I'm glad you didn't ask me how many he had, because I would have guessed 35 or 40 last year. He's not a big facet of the passing game. You're not moving him all around the formation and designing stuff for him and dictating matchups for other guys the way you use him. He's not Austin Ekeler or Alvin Kamara. That doesn't mean he's not important in the passing game, but he's not changing your passing game. So, and if Jacksonville, another quite frank statement, if they had better receivers and tight ends last year, Fournette would not have had as many catches. So I just don't know what you would want him for. Not that he's not a quality player, but guys like that are common, Gary. It's just they're common. They're very common.
Jordan Howard, you think? Could he get a deal like that?
No, I think Howard's a much better player than Fournette. Yeah. And the other, remember, Fournette's had some attitude issues that has rubbed some people really the wrong way over the years, so there's maturity questions to some. Even if there aren't any of those off-field, let's call it off-field, maturity questions or injury issues, it's just nothing special there.
Well, the catch-22 for him is, let's say he does emerge as a guy who looked like he was the fourth overall pick in the draft and has his breakout year and stays healthy in 2020, he's going to get banged for the workload after that. And then on top of that, everyone's going to say, well, workload plus, you know, durability. I don't see how he is more than a guy who sort of bounces around year to year. I think he sticks around the league, but I don't think anyone's ever going to invest a multi-year contract in the guy.
I agree. I think he'll be he's a 1-2 punch running back, and he's probably punch number two, and punch number one needs to be a scat back for you. So, like what the Bills just drafted in Zach Moss to kind of accompany Devin Singletary, that's the kind of back. Fournette is a Zach Moss type of guy in terms of his role. Different runners, but in terms of the role.
Yeah. Let's go on to the, we'll lump these guys in quickly because they do play the same position. Back in the 2017 draft, we have three receivers go in the top nine picks, and then Patrick Mahomes went 10, but, three receivers in the top nine picks, Corey Davis, Mike Williams, and John Ross. Mike Williams did have his fifth year option, exercised by the Chargers. So he'll be staying there through 2021. But we have Corey Davis in Tennessee and John Ross in Washington. I guess we'll start with Davis here. And look, the price tag on these guys for 2021 was going to be $15.7 million. We saw the receiver market deflated because of the, historically deep rookie class coming in a receiver. And quite frankly, next year's rookie class of receiver is outstanding as well. Sounds like a hot take if I say it's better than this year's. We'll see what happens, but it's a very
last
good...
year's was good too. That's going to be 3 years in a row. Maybe they're just good wide receivers now. At some point, it's all relative. If there are 20 good receivers and 20 teams get them, then the value of your good receiver is not the same as it is if there are only 10 or so. So I mean, maybe it's just a wide receiver league after a while.
I feel like 2019 was deep. 2020 was good up top and deep, and 2021 is great up top, and we'll see how deep they go, but they look like they're going to be pretty deep there. But that's all to kind of make the point that, you know, a Corey Davis or a John Ross, even if you were bullish on them, and I'm not sure exactly why you would be, but the price tag was $15.7 million for 2021, and that's just, I mean, we saw guys settle for much less than that, and frankly, better players settled for much less than that in the free agent market last year. So, frankly, I'm slightly surprised that Mike Williams had his exercise, but it's not that eyebrow raising. But let's talk about Davis, who sort of showed flashes sometimes. You kind of wonder if he was, like Marcus Mariota, maybe a victim of all the schematic changes there, and in Davis's case, of course, uneven quarterback play. And then last year, you know, A.J. Brown took off for them, and Davis was, he was fine as number two, but he wasn't, you know, he wasn't anything special. He wasn't a fifth overall pick of the draft type of guy.
So what I'll be interested to see, and we'll learn more this season, when A.J. Brown arrived, Davis, let's start when Davis arrived in 2017, he has the body of a big X receiver, the guy that plays by himself on the weak side of the formation, lines up right up on the ball, runs post routes, go routes, sometimes medium range slant routes. Think like what Dez Bryant was in Dallas a few years ago. That's a great example of an X receiver. Davis was that style of body, and therefore the expectation, I'm sure by many, was he's that style of wide receiver. And he was inconsistent and at times invisible or borderline invisible. And I think what you described is a lot of the factors that were behind it. Inconsistent quarterback play, changing systems. There was never a constant in Tennessee. This year, there has been a constant because this past year, A.J. Brown arrived. They were running the zone system 2 years in a row now. LaFleur had installed it, and then Arthur Smith took it over, and Arthur Smith did an unbelievable job as their offensive coordinator last year. So there's now some stability. And Davis's role in that system changed. A.J. Brown came in, and Brown became the X receiver as the season went on.
Mm-hmm.
And Davis was more the what they call the movement Z, the guy that goes in motion and runs intermediate routes. He's not a natural movement Z body type, but it's a different role for him. And there were times that I kind of liked him in it. Never in a way like, oh my good, where's Corey Davis lining up? Got to find him. But it'd be interesting to see if a team, let's say the Titans are going to play him in this role again. They're not going to have him be X and then move A.J. Brown around a whole lot, I don't think. It'll be interesting to see how Davis does this year because the movement Z role that he had, it kind of developed as the season progressed more than anything. I don't know if it was exactly the plan to play the receivers where they did last year. That's just how it unfolded. I'll be interested to see how things go this season for Corey Davis.
Yeah, he just, to me, he profiles as a guy who is, you know, a quality starting receiver, a quality second or third guy on your depth chart. I don't know if you'll ever really see that production from him in Tennessee, and I don't know. I'm interested to see what kind of market he has. I don't think the Titans will regret declining this option. I can't see that scenario playing out, but yeah, he's a solid player. He's a solid NFL starter to me.
I would agree. And so the function of the decision on the option then was just the price tag with it. I don't know if it was a commentary on Davis as much as it just was on how much they were willing to spend for him. It's kind of back to the Leonard Fournette thing. You can find guys like that in other areas. But Gary, there are teams over the years that have had Davis face number one corner. The defense has traveled the number one corner with Davis. In fact, it's happened quite often. That's not going to happen this season. So early last year, like I remember Denzel Ward in week one had Davis a lot of the time, or some of the times Ward traveled with him. You're not going to see that kind of stuff this year for Tennessee, and that could help Davis a lot as well.
Now let's go on to John Ross, fastest man in combine history. He just hasn't been able to stay in the lineup. It was interesting early last year. I mean, look, he had two big games to start the season. They played at Seattle and they hosted the 49ers. And look, they got pasted by the 49ers, so kind of empty stats. But still, he had 158 yards against the Seahawks and two touchdowns. He had 112 against the 49ers. Now, I think bringing in T. Higgins sort of signaled that they're ready to move on from Ross because they're not going to move on from Boyd. Maybe if they're expecting it's A.J. Green's last season in Cincinnati, maybe you end up hanging on to all three somehow. But he's just a guy, he hasn't been able to stay on the field. I guess my question to you, Andy, is we know he's fast. I thought at Washington, he showed, University of Washington, he showed the ability to be more than a speed guy. And I don't really think you've seen that in the NFL.
You haven't, and I would imagine a lot of that has to do with his unavailability. He has not been on the field enough. That's a major issue. I know it's a concern in Cincinnati with that coaching staff. They feel like he's a critical piece for what they're doing. He's going to be a critical piece for any offense that you put him in just because of the speed element that he brings. If you're not on the field a whole lot, it's hard to become more than just a one-trick pony.
Yeah, I think he sticks around the league for a long time. I think he's Ted Ginn. I think he's just one of those dudes who just put him in there because you have to respect the speed, and he'll have a home in the NFL for the next 5 years.
Well, and Ted Ginn is a really interesting player because after he turned 30-something years old, he got better. He's not a star, but Ginn became more than just a downfield north and south vertical weapon. He expanded his route tree a little bit. He'll never have the most natural of hands, so there's always going to be some hint of limitation to how you can use him. But Ginn became more than just a speedster. I think that's a great comparison you make for Ross. And Ross could potentially be a better all-around version again. I'd love to see those two in a race. My sense is Ginn at his best was probably faster. He's a more fluid runner than Ross. I don't know who's faster. They're both fast, but I think that's a good guy that you mentioned there, Gary. Is Ted Ginn's an example that in the right setup, if you do stay healthy, stay in the right system for a while, you can become something more than just a one-dimensional wide receiver. Ross just hasn't given himself that opportunity because he's been unavailable, and then they've had some system changes in Cincinnati here and there, and that doesn't help either for a guy that's unavailable.
You'd have to have vintage Ted Ginn, not current Ted Ginn.
Right. No, that's what I was thinking. At their height, at their very best. Ginn's both fast and long and quick and long striding. Like, he is just such a fluid mover. He looks like he's eating up ground more. That doesn't necessarily mean he's faster, but and I haven't seen Ross run enough, I guess. I've seen Ginn run for 12 years now or whatever it is.
That was I had this conversation with Jim Tressel. He brought up Ted Ginn as a guy who's not only fast, but he maintains his top speed better than anyone he has ever seen. And he thinks that has a lot to do with the track background, which a lot of these guys have. But he said Ginn was the best at getting to top speed and then just staying at top speed for whether it's a punt return or a nine route, and just maintaining that speed.
That's a great point. That's a really great point. And remember what Ginn was drafted for? Remember when Miami took him and how that was received?
Yeah, because they all wanted Brady Quinn.
Well, yeah, the Dolphin fans wanted Brady Quinn. And the Dolphins themselves, obviously, they didn't want Quinn because they didn't take him. Devin Hester was a superstar at that time, and people thought Ginn would be the next Devin Hester in the NFL. They drafted him for his return prowess. And it never quite, I mean, Ginn's a good returner, never quite became that. And I don't think, when's the last time Ginn returned a kick or a punt or
anything? That's a really good question.
I'm going to look that up. I'll do it while you stall. You stall.
Now I got to stall. Okay. Yeah. Well, I was going to ask the supercomputer. I will say he has not returned a kick since 2010.
All right. That's a long time ago. Let me see what I can pull up here. His last return,
I'm not even
2017
close.
With New Orleans. He had 19 kick returns or 19 punt returns. None of them for more than all were under 20 yards. Kick returns. He has not really returned kicks full time since kind of 2016. A little bit. He had 18 that year. Arizona 2014. I don't even remember him in Arizona at all. 2014. That was not the year the Cardinals went to the championship the next year. The point with Ginn, he never became Devin Hester in the return game. Never quite became that. But, you know, you can't. The league has changed so much now. You never would consider drafting a guy for his return prowess. That wouldn't get a guy drafted in the first, second, or third round. Not if that's his number one strength.
Yeah, I mean, that's, the Saints went and just signed Deontay Harris as an undrafted free agent, and he was arguably the best return specialist in the league last year. So,
do you think Hester's a Hall of Famer?
Oh gosh, no, but I'm open to it. That's the thing. I don't want to spoil anyone's fun. He was the best return specialist of all time. I just don't know if that's a position that deserves a Hall of Fame spot. Though I guess if kickers are getting in now, that's fine. I don't object to him being in, but my gut sense is no. What do you think?
Well, if we say the answer is no, then we're saying that you can never put a return guy in the Hall of Fame. We're saying what you just said.
Correct.
And,
yes.
And that would be setting a precedent. That's probably a hard precedent to detach from because the return game's diminishing over time as we go along. Mm-hmm. I think he is a Hall of Famer because of the way, not only for the plays he made, but the way he influenced field position on the plays he did not make. The people kicking away from him or the decisions that opposing teams made in regards to third and fourth down or what do we do about our kickoffs. He influenced field position more consistently than any guy in the league. And if you add up those factors, for one, just the unsettling feeling you get when you're punting the ball and you know you can only punt it to 10% of the field, you got to go right out of bounds with it. That's one, but two is all the yards you're giving up. If you add those yards up and count them as return yards, which they're effectively the same thing, then Hester's numbers just blow everyone away through the roof because there's nobody else that would have that influenced field position that way. The closest guy I saw was maybe Deion Sanders when I was a kid when he returned, but he wasn't the full-time return guy the way. Not in his Cowboys and Niners years. Sanders wasn't quite the full-time return guy that Hester was.
I like the fact that I played the bad guy on this. I feel like that was role reversal for us, which is nice.
Yeah, because you would guess that I'd be the one that says he's not on the field enough for it.
Yeah, and especially, have you ever seen a special teams play?
not in a while. That is true. I have not in a while, but I have, but not, you know, it's not something I've had time to break down. And honestly, Gary, and I'm certainly not going to tell you who, but I've had head coaches say to me that they know nothing about special teams and they just want the ball in the 25 and get the hell out of the way special teams.
Yeah.
And it's not a disrespect on it. Everybody agrees it's important. It's just there's not enough time you do have to have a special teams coach who's a real expert because there's not enough time to invest in offense and special teams or defense and special teams as a schemer. Unless maybe you're Bill Belichick. He's done it okay, I guess.
There you go. Bill Belichick loves his special teams. Jonathan Jones wrote that piece for us a couple years ago. Everyone's written that piece, but Jonathan Jones culled every Patriots press conference and gathered all the Belichick special teams using since into one place because Jonathan Jones is a smart man and that was a good idea and it was really entertaining.
Well, and John Harbaugh is a former special teams coach and I know the Ravens feel there's a lot of value to that. That really helps. But even then, Harbaugh, because of his responsibilities, you know, he only interjects in special teams every once in a while. When he does interject, it's he can tell you anything and everything and all the why behind it. And he impresses people, but it's not possible for a head coach to bring his full value and expertise to special teams. There's just not enough time for it. So in Belichick, he's great, but, you know, his assistants are doing most of the special teams work, you have to imagine.
And to sort of trace this back, this is like the old Sesame Street thing with the bottle of milk container of something and a stick of butter. Do you remember that?
No, I do not know what you're talking. I mean, I watched Sesame Street, but I do not have any idea what you're talking about.
The kid had to, it was animated, the kid had to remember how to get home from the store and what to get at the store and that sort of thing and the things that he passed, but that was that's what came to mind as we go. We were on like a tangent of a tangent of a tangent.
Well, it's when you're talking about these guys that don't get their fifth year option picked up. Special teams is probably a relevant conversation for some.
That is, and I was going to bring it back to John Ross, who has not done any special teams work for the Bengals, but he had four kick return touchdowns in three seasons at Washington. So you wonder if that's a way he can be used going forward.
Well, if that's the case, whoever's doing that will probably use him as the number four receiver because the thoroughness of his durability concerns, injuries at different body parts at different times of the year, off season and in season. If he's your number one, or he's not going to be anyways number one, but if he's your number two or number three receiver, that's what you're hoping he can be. You're not going to take the risk of putting him in on special teams. I mean, his best long-term play probably is that Ted Ginn route. Be a number four receiver and a return guy.
Yeah. No, I think that's fair. and that's a perfectly respectable career to have. But we'll see. We'll see what the market is for him coming out of the 2020 season. Let's move on, though, to the guy. I mean, look, this was the most shocking decision of all the fifth-year options. Malik Hooker gets his option declined, the Colts safety. It was only $6.8 million. This is not... the safety market's been very strange the last couple years. We had the one offseason where no one was getting signed, and then you have like Landon Collins got the monster deal, and this past offseason, a little bit in between, the Vikings are kind of hanging on to Anthony Harris on the franchise tag, seeing if they can trade him. We'll see if they do. But Malik Hooker, the Colts turned down $6.8 million. They've been saying that they still want a long-term role for him. I just want to talk to you about the second half of that Colts season, Andy. Mm-hmm. The secondary really struggled down the stretch. And I think part of it was Pierre Desir, who they let go of. And Desir was a nice sort of underdog story there, and he just sort of fell off late last season, and that's how it went. Hooker, though, he's a risk taker. Spends a lot of time looking into the backfield, and he gave up a couple of big plays. That Texans Thursday night game that they lost, sort of a mistake filled game for the Colts that sort of swung their season. Hooker was basically the guy who got moved out of position on a couple of big Texans plays. I just wonder if the Colts sort of said, like, you know, maybe we're just looking for more reliability on the back end there, because you love physically what Malik Hooker is, and you know, if you like a risk-taking safety, a ball-hawking guy, he's your guy.
Yeah, he is your guy. Kenny Moore getting injured last year, he was unavailable for, I'm looking up which games exactly he missed, because he missed five games in 2019. And when he's not on the field, Moore was such an exceptional all-around. He is such an exceptional all-around slot corner. When he's not on the field, I think the Colts feel there are coverages that they can't play as much. They have to be a little bit more vanilla, have to play a little bit more straight zone rather than matchup zone or even man-to-man, which they get into every once in a while. So they became a more vanilla defense on the back end. They don't have a good enough pass rush to overcome being a vanilla defense on the back end last year. Mm-hmm. And so the whole secondary, as you said, it just wasn't the same unit. It was not as good of a secondary. And then the question is, well, how much does Hooker factor into that? And to give some context to what you said about that $6.8 million, so the safeties right now, the highest paid safety in the NFL on an average per year basis is Eddie Jackson, Chicago at $14.6 million, Kevin Byard, $14.1 million, Tyrann Mathieu, $14 million, $6.75 million, $7 million, that range. That's Patrick Chung, that's Bobby McCain. They're about the 16th, 17th highest paid. So you're at the bottom of the top quarter percentile. So you're kind of slightly above average, but not by much in terms of safety compensation. So what the Colts are saying is, we don't feel Hooker is better than 75 or even 70% of the safeties in the NFL. He's not more valuable than 70%. Does that change? I mean, when you hear it put that way, does that change your perception on the shock value of this?
No, I think when it comes down to it, and durability plays into it with him as well, but I think when it comes down to it, if Malik Hooker comes out of the season healthy and, you know, is reasonably in line with what he's been over the first three seasons of his career, I think he gets that. I think he gets $7 million plus annually for, you know, basically 3 years.
Yeah, I could see that. I'm looking up my film notes, by the way, because you got me curious with that Texans player talking about. There was a sequence last year that Hooker had some issues out of split safety coverage against teams were drawing up plays that beat cover four, and the Colts had some communication issues on the back end about who was responsible for vertical receivers against cover four, and Hooker was involved on a handful of those. So what we're talking about, we kind of agree what Malik Hooker is, it sounds like. Does that sound like that to you?
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, look, he's physically talented, and there's durability issues. But I was I was surprised by the move. It's a 1 year commitment, so it's not like are we going to sign this guy long term? But it's to me, it was just kind of like he's going to get this on the open market. Unless something goes disastrously wrong this season, he will get that kind of money on the open market in a multi-year deal. And I was just kind of surprised that the Colts weren't the team to give it to him. And I just wondered if it had to do with it was the two DeAndre Hopkins touchdowns. Definitely the first one in that Thursday night game. I'm pulling it up now, and I can't get like a muted clip, which is really
well.
Annoying,
I've got it. It's a 35-yard touchdown. Is that what it is?
Yeah. Hopkins had two long ones in that game, and mm-hmm. I believe it was the first one, the 35-yarder. And Hooker was just sort of staring into the backfield, and you know, it ended up being an easy pass and catch.
And so what happened on that play? And that's actually what we were just talking about a second ago. Is Hopkins, it was cover four, so each of the defensive backs have 1/4 of the field, and Hooker and Desir were on the same side of the field. So Hooker has the middle fourth on that side, Desir has the outer fourth, and Hopkins stemmed his route in such a way that he was kind of right between both of those guys, and they both thought the other guy was responsible for him based on the rules of the coverage. So and that's this kind of subtlety that you get from the really, I mean, a lot of receivers do that and they're taught that it's the NFL, but the great ones like Hopkins can really make it hard. So he drifted inside vertically, kind of going towards Hooker's responsibility. Desir thought, okay, Hooker has it. Hooker didn't feel that he'd gone inside far enough, and he was worried about Will Fuller, who was the guy already in his zone. And that's how you beat him, just like that. And that's the issue he had. He had an issue like that against the Titans, I want to say, and against the Bucks later in the year. And look, just a couple of those are enough to, I mean, the title of the position tells the main part of the story, the safety. And if you have a couple of those plays to where no longer does your coordinator feel safe with you back there, that's a hard thing to deal with. That's very hard. I know that in Seattle years ago, what those coaches loved about Earl Thomas, and this was at the height of the Seahawks defense, they felt Thomas was arguably their most valuable player, which really surprised opponents of Seattle, because I think a lot of people felt it was one of the linebackers or Richard Sherman or Michael Bennett. But there was such a comfort knowing that Earl Thomas was the guy back there in the range. Yeah. If you do, that comfort, I've been told, is very valuable to a defensive play caller. And you're Matt Eberflus. You do a lot of different things as the defensive coordinator in Indianapolis. If you're not comfortable with one of your safeties, that's a problem. That's a real problem.
If you just had Hooker back there in the defense where he's just single high, you know, let's say he's just in Seattle-style defense, I mean, does that make more sense for him?
It could. I've thought about that. And that's kind of the role he plays a little more overall. But, you know, he does match up the tight ends once in a while. I do think that is the role for him. But then let's just go through the list of guys. I'm just going to read off the top safeties, and I'll tell you which ones are the ones that pretty much only play single high. Eddie Jackson, no. Kevin Byard does a lot. Tyrann Mathieu obviously does a lot. Landon Collins is a box guy. Earl Thomas, you could say, is only single high. In Baltimore, though, they've asked him to do different things. He hasn't. It's been hit or miss on the results. But you could say Thomas is a single high safety. Devin McCourty plays all over. Justin Simmons plays all over. Anthony Harris, they play two deep, so no one's a single high there. Kareem Jackson plays in multiple spots. LaMarcus Joyner is really not supposed to be on this list. He's a slot corner. Mm-hmm. Harrison Smith, two safeties deep. Jordan Poyer, Jimmy Ward, you could say, is a single high safety. And we talked a few shows ago about how he slides into the slot, and that's a big part of his value. So I wouldn't even say Jimmy Ward is strictly a single high safety. So we're now 12, 15 into this list. Adrian Amos is next, Malcolm Jenkins, Patrick Chung. None of these guys are truly just center fielders, single high safeties. It's not till you get to probably Ricardo Allen for the Falcons. And even he's not bad when he goes to strong safety. It's probably Quandre Diggs, our guy in Seattle, who should be getting $30 million a year, in my opinion. But he's probably the first guy on the list who's a true free safety, and his value's at $6.2 million a year in Seattle. So how much are you going to pay a guy to just stand back there in center field?
Well, if he's if he's fast, if he's good, if he sort of allows the rest of your defense to play how you want it to play.
Yeah, no, that's no, you're right. That's what the Seahawks coaches used to say about Earl Thomas, because Thomas, when he was a Seahawk, was absolutely a single high safety. He rarely came down and played strong safety. What you have to consider as well, what a lot of teams do now is their best cover safety plays strong safety in pass situations. And because you want those guys near the middle of the field for in-breaking routes and all that. So There aren't a lot of guys that just patrol center field anymore. It's versatility at safety is critical for disguising coverages and then for having diversity in your matchups on obvious passing situations, third down and long. And even Earl Thomas, I remember in Seattle's final few years, he would switch spots with Cam Chancellor on third and long and go play strong safety because they wanted him in the middle of the field where those in-breaking routes are likely to go. Or those crossing routes. We talk all the time about the crossing routes against cover three.
What's your gut feeling on Hooker?
I think if he plays well this year, he's going to get paid by somebody next year. It's that the safety position is just becoming more and more valuable. We've been saying that for years, and I still think it's true. Look what Matthew did for the Chiefs this year, or the Titans, and the value they get out of Bayer. Those are the AFC Championship representatives. So I think he'll get paid if he plays well. If he does not, or if he has injuries, then he might be one of those one-year, $5 million contract guys. I'll try it next year.
All right. Let's move on to our last two here, neither of which were particularly surprising. Garrett Bowles is the first one here. The Broncos left tackle. He was the 20th overall pick of the 2017 draft. And, I mean, look, it's so tough when you miss on an offensive line pick in the first round because there's just no depth across the league at that position, and if you don't get a guy there, you just really don't have anyone to replace him. There's no plan B, and obviously the Broncos took some time to see what they had in Bowles. They declined the option. It would have been worth $11.1 million in 2021. I mean, look, on one hand, Bowles is so penalty prone. this is about to sound ridiculous. Penalty prone and prone to giving up sacks, which are absolute. Everyone notices that. Everyone sees that. Everyone tracks that. Those are like big red flags. Is there anything you can see in him that's sort of like, well, beyond the numbers, if you take away his 15 worst plays, he's not bad. Type of thing, or is he just really too far gone at this point?
No, what you've described me, I have thought that before. There was a game last year, early in the season, week two against Chicago, where he had four holding penalties in the game. That's a lot. Yeah. I mean, if you average one a game, you have a good chance of leading the NFL or being right in there for it. So to have four in a game, that's a lot. Three of them came in the run game, and one of them was a BS call where it was a bad call. And the other two, he was just grabbing in a phone booth. Then there was one where Khalil Mack got him on a speed rush. And Bowles had actually done a decent job against Mack prior to that play. So the takeaway out of that, after that game was over, oh my gosh, Bowles, four fouls. It happened at home, so the crowd's booing him, so it even makes it even worse. And it's only week two, so we kind of have set the narrative for the season. Now, Bowles has too many penalties, absolutely, and it was a problem throughout the year, but it was not the problem, probably, that it felt to some of the hardcore Denver fans. I don't know if it was a crippling issue with him.
It's the old Flozell Adams thing, where Flozell Adams was a solid player. He had a lot of penalties, and when you get a penalty, they announce your number, and they show you on TV, and it just sort of it's tough to overcome from like a perception standpoint.
Correct. Yeah. And I'm looking there through week nine. I'm going back through my Garrett Bowles notes now. He had 11 penalties through week nine, which led the NFL at that time. There were some good pass rushers that made him look bad. Like you've said, his bad plays. I had this conversation with a coach a few years ago about Deion Sims at tight end. because Deion Sims would get destroyed as a blocker at times. And I said, I just casually mentioned to the coach, you know, you probably don't trust Deion Sims as your number two tight end. And he said, well, no, it's we do actually. His losses are horrible. They look bad, but they're not, they're few and far between. He gives up home runs is all.
Yeah.
That's kind of how it is with Bulls. And so then the discussion is that good enough? And for a left tackle, a lot of what teams are paying for is the kind of the Earl Thomas thing again, the insurance policy, the safety that you feel from having a left tackle or any tackle at this point in the NFL that can play one-on-one or that you trust over there. But Gary, there are only, you know, how many guys in the league are blocking Khalil Mack or even a Justin Houston who got Bulls a couple times last year? You know, how there's a Bulls is an NFL starting tackle still just because there's such a paucity of them across the league.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel that way too. The other thing working against him, he did come into the league older. He was 25 when he was drafted, so he'll hit the open market as a 29-year-old. I think a lot of offensive tackles have, this is kind of more anecdotally, but, you know, a lot of these guys have aged well. So, it's been 3 years. Can he turn a corner here? Or is he always just going to be sort of a mistake prone guy? I like that metaphor he gave about giving up home runs. I don't know.
Let's remember, home runs count too.
They do. Absolutely. Look, I'm a big time sabermetrics guy with my baseball fandom, and every once in a while you look at all the peripheral numbers, and it's like, oh, strikeout to walk ratio, fielding independent pitching and stuff like that, and then it's like, oh yeah, he also gave up, you know, 40 home runs and 50 innings, and that's the problem.
And you could make a strong argument that the most damaging play in the NFL from an offense's perspective is a sack fumble, because for one, you're turning the ball over and the ball's not even traveling through the air. So the ball's getting turned over right where you are. So big field position swing. For two, if it's scooped up, there's nobody to tackle because you're in the backfield already. So return touchdowns. Three is the quarterback got hit. And four is if you recover it yourself, you are so usually those sack fumbles happen on deeper dropbacks. You're going to be so far behind the chains that it ruins the drive anyway. So 11 drives in a game, one of them gets torpedoed by a sack fumble. That's the biggest swing play in the NFL. The more you think about it, it's worse than an interception.
Yep.
And so that's why teams pay all that money for their left tackle. And that's why teams get really concerned when they see one guy who struggles with the same, when he does struggle, it's the same format every time. He struggles with the bull rush and the speed and dip benders. You know, he struggles against really good pass rushers. And then this, all right, well, then the question is, what's he worth? What is that worth?
Yeah, I took a lot of heat for that take with, I was pointing out Matthew Stafford, who, by the way, if you stripped away win-loss records at the halfway point last year, and you have to remember the halfway point, Lamar Jackson had two or three dud games at that point. But at the halfway point last year, I thought Matthew Stafford was the best player in the league to that point.
Really? I've had some heat over the years for loving Stafford. I never quite loved him that much.
One of the points I wanted to make, and again, let me point out, Lamar Jackson had two or three duds. Jackson had such a monster second half of the year, he would have been MVP. Patrick Mahomes was not playing great in the first half of the year. He had some injury issues, and they had some offensive line issues there. But the thing with Stafford was all of his turnovers were coming on like 30-yard passes downfield on like second and long and third and long. And I just sort of made the point, like, these are not, you know, no one's rooting for turnovers. They're not good, but if you're going to have turnovers, and he did not have many turnovers, but you're going to have a few turnovers, those are kind of fine. Those are not really problematic. And, you know, Stafford on one hand, and then, you know, Daniel Jones, who we talked about a couple weeks ago, he desperately needs to clean up the fumbles because those are completely back-breaking plays.
Yeah, I'm actually I have all the interceptions last year charted right now for something I'm doing. I'm looking at the Stafford interceptions because he had one that was in garbage time. Four of them, five out of seven, traveled 20 plus yards through the air. That's a very big number. And yeah, it was one on third down and 19. There was one on third down and 10. And there was a couple of third and longs. And actually, those were the only two that did not travel 20 yards through the air. So your point is backed up by facts, Gary.
First half MVP. They should have given him the trophy before he shattered his spine or whatever.
Because he threw the best interceptions there were,
yes,
is what you're saying.
He threw the best interceptions. He was really good.
Yeah.
That was I did not think my take was that hot, and people were really upset about it.
Well, Stafford is a classic example of a guy who football people love and fans don't fully appreciate, not to the degree that the football people do. When you talk about Matthew Stafford to coaches in the NFL, if you casually refer to Stafford as elite and you kind of lump him in there with some of those other guys, maybe not quite Brady or maybe even not Rodgers, but nobody bats an eye when you say Stafford's elite. And if you just listed them all, Breeze, you know, Rodgers, Wentz, Roethlisberger, whoever you feel, and you put Stafford in there, they're not going to correct you necessarily. He is highly regarded by a lot of people.
Highly regarded by me.
And Gary. A lot of people and Gary.
That's right. Let's go to Gary on Conley here.
One more thing on Bulls, by the way.
Yeah, no, yes, of course.
We had spent plenty of time there. Jack Conklin really struggled his first 3 years in the NFL. Was great, or not great, but he was very good in year four last year, and yep, it worked out well for him. He got a big contract because there are so few tackles. If Bulls plays very well this year, I don't think there's a lot that would make you say he won't get a Jack Conklin type opportunity somewhere. I think Bulls' struggles have been I'm going to take it back. Conklin, I think, was every bit as problematic as Bulls on his bad plays those first 3 years.
I'm glad you brought up that point. That was worth interjecting with.
Good.
That was not sarcastic, by the way. I know it kind of
sounds
sarcastic.
I feel good about it.
Let's go to Gary and Conley, drafted 24th overall by the Raiders, traded to the Texans last season. The Texans kind of collected some sort of ex-first rounders to plug into their secondary. But what do we make of Conley at this point? That Texans secondary whenever I think of the Texans secondary, I think that the parts are decent, pretty good. And they just never add up to the sum of the parts. It just seems like there are always issues with coverages on the back end.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that's a good way to say that. Is the sum of the parts or whatever you said. Say it again. The whole equals sum of the parts thing.
I guess they don't. The whole does not equal the sum of the parts.
Yeah, that's right.
Case.
Yeah, I think that's a good way. Yeah, I think that's a good way to say that. You can see why Conley was drafted where he was drafted. The talent is apparent. It's how much do you trust him and how are you going to use him? And then how much is his number, Gary? What does he cost?
Would have been 10.2 for 2021.
Yeah, which is that's probably reasonable for a higher level cornerback.
And it was a little bit surprising. Look, they traded a third round pick, and not that a third round pick is the end all be all. And Bill O'Brien has certainly not sort of gone with a traditional valuation of draft picks. But I was a little bit surprised that they didn't exercise the option, just because you've already invested the draft capital. And let's say Conley does have a good year here. When they sort of sit down with them, it's going to kind of be like, well, I mean, you gave up a day two pick for me, so of course you got to invest in me now, because you're going to look ridiculous if you gave up a day two pick and gave up on me after, whatever it would be, 20 games.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think Conley down, I'm just, the theme of the show is me just pulling up my notes and word searching these guys while we're talking here. Conley had a very solid second half of last season. He had some nice moments. I think when you get into an expensive cornerback, the conversation has to be a little bit about how are you using him? Because corners, a lot of their best work comes when the play does not involve them. That's just the nature of the position. Conley, if he's getting in the 10-something range as a corner, puts him about 15 or so as a top in terms of cornerback salary. Bradley Roby's on that deal with Houston now already at 10.5 a year on average. So that has to factor in as well, I think, is how much you're investing at one position. But I'm kind of with you. I was a little surprised Houston didn't want to take the Conley option. Now, if he plays great and they decide we have to keep him, is that the worst thing in the world? How much money will they have lost by not taking the option for that fifth year if they do it that way? And keep in mind, if he plays great and we have to keep him, you're signing him to a long-term deal. So it's you're still you're not in a, I don't think you're in a wholly different position than you would have been if you'd just used a fifth year option on him.
The other thing I'll point about Conley point out about Conley sort of in his defense is he has played behind some of the worst pass rushes in football in his career so far, because I mean, look, he arrived in Houston and J.J. Watt was hurt, and before that he played in Oakland behind those just, you know, post Khalil Mack terrible Raiders pass rushes.
It's a fantastic point. That's a tremendous point. And those Raiders and Texans schemes are also very different. Oakland's going to ask you to be more of a zone corner. They did when he was there, and the Texans have more matchup coverages. And last year, the Texans really became a single high man-to-man defense. They did that more than any team in the league in some regards. So Conley's done a lot of different things in his career as well. If you told me I had to have Gary and Conley as one of my starting corners, I'd feel good about that.
Okay. Andy, before we wrap this up, I can't emphasize how important this part of the show is. I kind of need your take on the new Rams uniforms, polarizing uniforms.
I take the optimistic side on uniforms.
Okay.
I tend to be positive towards it. I'll say this. I actually emailed Chargers ownership after their uniforms came out and just said, I have never seen a team's uniforms so well received, and not just in Los Angeles, but anywhere. I mean, everybody loved the Chargers. I've never seen that happen. That doesn't happen anymore. Uniforms are a great thing that people can criticize, and really it's kind of a freebie criticism because it just gets treated that way. Everyone loved the Chargers uniforms. I'm sure that factored into how some people reacted to the Rams uniforms. To each his own. How about that?
Oh, my God. What a disappointing take.
I'm all right with the uniform. I really am. I need to see how they look. What bugs me anymore are teams don't come out with just uniform. They now have like combinations. We've talked about this. They have combinations. They have different pants, different jerseys. I've heard they might get rid of the one helmet color rule or one helmet rule, so they're going to have different like helmet colors. I've grown to hate that. I loved that as a kid when the Cowboys double star jerseys, the first time I saw those, oh my goodness. I hate all the uniform diversification now that happens. So I mean, that's just colors a little bit. When it's a team that's a classic uniform team and they fall into that, I do struggle with that a little bit. Now, the Browns are different, though. The Browns went back to their old look, and they're going to do the 5,000 different uniform combinations. And for some reason, with them, it doesn't bother me a whole lot, and I'm guessing that's because they don't have a logo, so it doesn't feel the same way. But I don't know. What did you think of the Rams uniforms?
I thought they were disappointing. I thought there was no reason to change the helmet. They already had the best helmet in football.
You think so?
Yeah. Oh, I love the ram horns.
Well, I like
ram horns. They're just sort of like, you know, I don't know, very geometry, math teacher head horns at this point. I don't know what you call those.
Shapey. Well, they're painted on horns is what they are. Yeah. That's what you would call. But
it's what they are. That
or
is
are they? They're probably stickered on. They're probably not painted on. They're stickered on.
I actually have no idea.
What's impressive is how often all the stickers are straight in the NFL. That's the helmets. They do a nice job of decaling them.
God, that's a great question. Yeah.
What are they painted or decal or stickered?
Painted or decaled. I think they're painted.
I bet they're stickered.
All right.
Well, I mean, someone can find it. Do people still tweet us this kind of thing? I bet they do. We haven't exchanged emails like that in a while.
I'm sure someone has done this story and someone will tweet it at us. But if not, I'll reach out to a couple teams.
I like it. I think I like it when the logo on the helmet flows with the helmet. Like it's a ram horn or it's a Bengal stripe. It's a Viking horn. Like it's not just the logo. It's an interactive logo. The eagle's yes. wings that fly yep. back at the helmet. I guess I like that. I like it on some teams. I don't know. Because the more I think about it, my favorite uniforms probably at my core, if I just took a polygraph and they were somehow able to tell what I really think, because I don't even know what I really think. It's Bears. It's Cowboys in the white. It's the Niners in the red. Green Bay. Just the uniforms that I grew up with. Straightforward. Here's the logo. Here's the uniform. The colors. Don't they look nice? Let's play. Okay. Steelers.
Yeah.
Chiefs.
No, and I'm with that. What I really didn't like about the Rams, I didn't like the change with the helmet, though it's not a huge change. The gradient number, I'm not a fan of it. When you have that yellow, like, why would you dilute that yellow?
I don't necessarily disagree with that. I love the look of yellow because it always looks good with whatever other uniforms out there. It always contrasts well with the opposing team's uniforms. And I think that's a big factor. So, like, people, I know there's a big movement right now. Well, not a huge movement, but it's something you hear all the time. Eagles should bring back the Kelly Green jerseys.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't want that because, for one, if the Eagles' current greens were from the 80s and 90s, those are the ones everybody would say bring back. People are just saying bring it back because that's what they had in the 80s and 90s, and it's cool to like that retro type of thing. But I like it when the colors are diversified. We already have that kind of green in the NFL. The Jets are somewhat similar to it. The Packers, we don't have any of the dark bluish green, 80% green, 20% blue. We don't have that color anywhere else except on the Eagles. So I like it when the uniforms all correlate with each other across the league. And I'm sure the league, I'm sure they look into that, but maybe they don't because they let the Titans pretty much take the exact same uniform approach as the Texans, and those teams were already hard to get straight in your head at times anyway. So
yeah,
I don't know, but I'm glad the Rams are blue and yellow and not blue and white. I do like the yellow a lot.
Well, and I like the bone instead of the white. And you would have thought I would have been disappointed because I thought it was going to have to do with some sort of promotion with the show Bones, but it didn't. It was just the color Bone.
The first time I ever ruined something on a DVR, I deleted my sister's recording of Bones. She said, I wanted to watch Bones. And I felt terrible. She's 3 years younger than me. She'd had a tough week at school. I was high school. She's junior high. And I deleted her show Bones. That's all I know about Bones. DVRs were new, by the way. It wasn't like I was being awful.
Yeah, like TiVo days. I don't know. I don't think I ever watched an episode of Bones, but I remember when it was just promoted nonstop, and it's just a funny word to say, Bones. But I do like the Rams bone uniform, and this is one other thing I was thinking about, and it kind of ties into the Eagles and the sort of the more muted green. What would you call it? Forest green that they wear now?
That's what they do call it. Yeah.
Okay.
They call it forest. And actually, I've heard that their black jerseys. I read this somewhere. Their black jerseys are actually super super dark green.
Oh really?
I don't know if that's true anymore, but I read that years ago.
I could see that. One thing I was wondering, though, is yellow is so easy to differentiate for, like, the human eye. Like, yellow really sticks out. So, you had that in Boise, where they decided Boise State couldn't wear all blue uniforms on the blue turf because, it sort of just made it difficult for opponents to be able to decipher the bodies downfield. And I kind of wondered, yellow is the complete opposite. Yellow is the most visible, the most whatever you want to call it. I'm sure there's a scientific word. I'll just call it popping for the sake of this. But like the Penguins had a goaltender who used to wear yellow leg pads, and then someone told him like the yellow leg pads make it much easier for the shooters to see where the openings are. So why don't you not wear the yellow leg pads anymore? But mm-hmm. I do wonder if that had some sort of role in not using a yellow alternative uniform, which they don't have one, right? They had just the blue and the bone, right?
I'm sure they can invent a yellow one in a few days if Nike suggests it's a good idea. I've heard that. I think Kevin Demoff, the czar of the Rams, said that they have other combinations that they haven't revealed yet necessarily. So I assume that their bone white can also have yellow pants with it at times. I don't know if they have a yellow jersey anymore, and Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know on that one.
Yeah, but that's that would be one other reason to keep the forest green. And I think the Eagles should wear Kelly green. But if you're going to keep the forest green, it does it blends in with the rest of the field.
I don't understand this.
It's a subtle advantage.
This Kelly green infatuation. I don't understand. You know why people like saying Kelly green? Kelly green. Kelly green.
It's almost as much fun to say as bones.
Yeah, bone. I had heard bone dry. Of course, I had not heard the term bone white. But I get it. I like it. How many teams? Because I did this when I was drifting off to sleep the other night. I counted how many teams do you think have traditional uniforms? Where here's our home jersey. Here's our road jersey. Maybe we might have a third jersey, but we're not changing our damn pants every week and flipping the jerseys around. We have regular classic uniforms, and then these new teams that have the multifaceted uniforms. How many do you think are on each side?
I feel like what do you consider multifaceted? Is three multifaceted?
Name a team, and I'll tell you if they're multifaceted or not.
Okay, I would think the team on the for instance, do you count the Steelers in this? Steelers
would be classic. For sure.
Yeah, but they have the bumblebee, and they have they brought back the sort of 80s, early 90s different font on the uniform. They had the yellow numbers for a little while.
Correct. Yeah, I think every team has a third jersey, so we have to understand and allow that.
Okay.
The teams if I say the Steelers are in their road uniforms this week, what are they wearing? Tell me what they'd be wearing.
They're wearing white. With yellow pants.
There. That now you know. I mean that's how that goes.
Have the Raiders ever worn a third?
They have their third is silver numbers instead of black. You don't have a lot of options when you're black and silver and white as your colors.
Yeah.
And I don't like it either because you can't see those numbers on film very well.
49ers have those 90s throwbacks.
Yeah, because Kyle Shanahan was a kid or in high school in the time when his dad was on the team with those throwbacks, so he likes them a lot.
Yeah.
And I guess they're all right. I didn't like those as much as a kid. That 1994 year when everyone wore throwbacks, so I had never seen that. That was a lot of fun back then.
Yeah. Yeah, that was good. I'm not a fan of that 49ers 90s throwback because that's when they started to not be good anymore.
Well, they won the Super Bowl in those throwbacks.
They did, but after that, they weren't good anymore.
I don't think they wore them after that, though. What happened in that 94 year is a lot of teams I remember it happened to the Niners and the Cowboys. They wore the throwbacks, and then they came out with new jerseys that were modernized, updated versions of the throwbacks. The Cowboys had the white jerseys with the blue sleeves and the white stars on top, and then they came out with the double star jerseys that had blue stars on top with the blue sleeves. It was the Niners. Remember after that 94 season, they soon went to the three-dimensional numbers as their main numbers, but they were back to their red, gold, and white and black combination, and they had the gold pants again. But remember when Jeff Garcia was here, or Steve Young, and the Owens caught it game against against Green Bay, picture those uniforms. They had they had different jerseys, and they weren't straightforward, plain-faced like they are now, or like they were in the Montana years.
I'm just talking the block shadow that they use.
Yeah, but I'm saying those new uniforms had the block shadow in them. They came out with new uniforms that were a mix of the throwback and the current. That's what Dallas did.
I'll have to dig on that one. You caught me off guard. You caught me unprepared for this debate.
That's okay. I mean, yeah, I'm unprepared too. If the answer, though, is how many teams have... but by my count, and we can probably debate all of them, I had 16 teams on each side. 16 traditional 16? Uniforms, and then 16 where it's like I'm looking at the Falcons here with their uniform reveal, and their pictures got, I think, 7 or 8 different guys in it for what their jerseys, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and that's not even all the possibilities there. They could still mix and match even more. So the Falcons would not be one of those classic teams.
Yeah. Boy, 16. That's more than I thought it was going to be.
I was relieved. I thought it'd be more than that for teams mixing it up, and it still might be. Nike's just getting started, perhaps.
The Colts. Colts don't have any third jersey, do they?
Colts would be a classic for sure. I'm trying to think. I don't know if they do have a third jersey. Yeah, I don't think they do.
All right, good for them. This is probably a good place to wrap it up, right?
Yeah, they did have a throwback jersey that they wore a few years ago.
The Colts did.
Yeah, and they wore blue helmets with it.
I don't remember that.
Yeah, they did.
Okay. Well, now I'm going to wrap it up then.
Yeah.
Can't stop me now. Nope. Andy, once again, thanks for joining us, and we'll call it just goodbye for now.
Sounds good. See you later.
The MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast is me, Gary Gramling. Special thanks once again to Andy Benoit for joining us this week. We are produced by Shelby Royston. SI's executive producer for podcasts is Scott Brody. Ben Eagle is director of editorial projects and product. Mark Mravick is emeritus editor of the MMQB. Andy Benoit is the founder of the MMQB NFL Podcast. Keep up with our entire lineup of podcasts 5 days a week by subscribing to the MMQB NFL Podcast for free on Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, please do us a favor and leave a rating and review. It really does help other people find the show, which is also available on Spotify, radio.com, Stitcher, SI.com, and wherever else you listen to podcasts.